We are in Proverbs 21 for today. I want to start today with number one because I think the first proverb in this chapter is a pretty profound one. And it's also a misunderstood one. We have this tendency to be black and white in our thinking as humans, which is a shame as well. And we have a tendency to take this first proverb is a black or white proverb. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. And the basic principle here is that God has the power and means to both determine and control every decision and word of a ruler. He has that ability. And he can do it. He can exercise that ability according to his own will. However, again, being realistic, practical. According to the Old Testament stories, God is selective as to when, where, and for what purposes he does this. He doesn't control every decision, every action of those in power, but he does sometimes. There's a word, providence, the providence of God. The picture that's commonly used in Bible colleges or seminaries is that on occasion God sticks his finger in the pie and he stirs it according to the way he wants it stirred. Yes. All the time? No. But sometimes. For example, one classic example, and there's, you know, within the Christian community there's been debate about this, and God is viewed as good and God is viewed as bad in light of the story, but during the 10 plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians, Pharaoh hardened his own heart the first 5 times. God didn't. Pharaoh did. God did not step in until plague 6. And then he stepped out in plague 7, and he stepped back in 8 through 10. So, why did God do this? I can't tell you for sure. But I do have my idea. And I believe that God did this for the same reason they raised up the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, and then he shut them down with the Medes and Persians. He raised up the Medes and Persians. He wanted to ensure that the Egyptians received their full punishment for how badly, how evil they were in the treatment of the Israelites. He didn't want Pharaoh backing out before they lost all their firstborn sons, just as they had killed the Jewish boys. There was genocide going on at the end of that enslavement of Israel by the Egyptians. They were killing the boy children, wipe out the nation, kill off the Jews. So God hardened his heart. And he said no, and the next plague came, and the last one was the angel of death. In Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, we read that God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, to send any Israelite who wanted to go back to Jerusalem, back to Jerusalem in order to rebuild the temple. God stepped in, and he turned the heart of the king in the direction he wanted it to go. In Jeremiah chapter 51:11, it says this, sharpen the arrows, fill the quivers. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of the Medes because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. For it is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance for his temple. Babylonians were just Chaldeans, and God made them a strong nation, and they became so strong that God used them to discipline the Israelites, both Israel and Judah, both sides of the border, so to speak, because of their evil. Worshipping idols, they were even burning their children in the fire, throwing them in the river, their own flesh and blood, their own babies, to appease the gods. And of course, there was all kinds of other activities that went with that. And this has been going on for a long time. One day for every year. Do you know that Ezekiel was to lay on his side for 390 some days. I forget the exact number. One day represented every year that Israel had sinned against the Lord. So the Lord had been that patient, gone that long. So the Lord stirred up the Medes and Persians to discipline the Babylonians because they were so evil in how they disciplined Israel. They were so cruel that then God brought them down and did it with the Medes. In Revelation chapter 17, verse 17, we read that God will put it in the hearts of the world rulers to join and serve the beast. And should we be alive and still here, I know that may go against some of your theology, so I'm not trying to debate the theology of this, but should we be alive and still here and you see the rulers of the world joining the beast, you could know that it has been predicted in the Word of God, Revelation 17, 17, that it is God who is stirring the pot. He's turning the hearts of the rulers in the direction he wants them to go. So, in my opinion, for the most part, rulers are good. Some are bad. All on their own. They don't need God turning them this way or that way. They have their own issues, their own greed, their own hunger for power, their own need for fame or fortune, their own cruelty, their own kindness. Yet there are times when God uses them in their positions of power to accomplish his purposes in our world, sometimes to their benefit. When he raised up the Babylonians, they got even more powerful. And when they took all the gold out of Israel, they got richer. That was to their benefit for a while. But also in the end to their hurt, because they lost everything to the Medes, the Persians. God never does this in an unjust or undue manner. It isn't just because he's a cruel, angry God. He does it to accomplish specific purposes. And they are all within justice. That's verse 1. Anybody else have thoughts on verse 1? Someone else. Another proverb, please.
I like the verse 4, where it says, haughty eyes and a proud heart, the unplowed field of the wicked produce sin. I thought it was very interesting that he's relating, he's making an illustration that when you have a proud heart that's looking down on others, it's like having a hard field that has not been broken up, and that would then mean that a humble heart is a heart that's been broken up, and that when we're humbled, well, when we are haughty, we need to be humbled, and when we're humbled, we tend to be more broken, we tend to be more willing to listen to God and slower to speak, just the danger of, you know, thinking that you know best or thinking that you are the most clever person or smartest person in the room or things like that. And even, especially in relation to God, that you know what's best. Oftentimes, it's our willfulness that leads us into sin. When we know what God says, but we think we have a better idea, and it's just interesting to me how valuable it is to see the danger of having a heart that, you know, thinks like that.
Mm-hmm. So the New American Standard has haughty eyes and a proud heart. The lamp of the wicked is sin, which is really not that much different. If you go back to the New Testament, where Jesus talks about the lamp of the body is the eye. If you think about it this way, your illustration is very good. Just this would be just a different way to say a very similar thing, in my opinion. when haughty eyes and a proud heart becomes the lens and the light that you use to decide how you will think and speak and behave, then the only possible outcome is sin. And that has to be changed, right? You have to have a different perspective. You have to have a different lens, a different light to see a different way in order to come to righteousness. Yeah. Yeah, just for those who are using New American Standard. All right, someone else, thanks.
I think it's interesting with the haughty eyes thing that it's an indication of what the heart, what's going on in the heart. It's in several places.
Yes. Yes, what is what is haughty? A haughty person is what?
Proud,
arrogant, has disdain for others, to use the word. Contemptuous, arrogant, looks down on, yeah, haughty eyes, proud heart, conceited, presumptuous, sees oneself better than we ought.
Verse 5, the plans of the diligent surely lead to profit, and everyone who is hasty surely rushes to poverty. Basically, they're comparing the diligent and the hasty and their results. Diligent and hasty are similar in some ways. Diligent persons generally could be considered hardworking. Someone who's hasty, they might be hardworking to some extent. But the difference is the diligent person is willing to plan and to look down the road and to stick with it to the end, whatever needs to be done to get to the end of the road. Whereas a hasty person maybe hasn't taken the time to plan, hasn't taken the time to look down the road, but just wants something as soon as possible. This proverb's very applicable to work and labor and making a living. If you're diligent, it might take a little longer, but you're liable to have something that's going to last in terms of an income or a work or career or whatever it is. If you're hasty, you might end up with a lot in a short time, but we've seen many examples of just in our lifetime of people who have come to a huge amount of wealth and lost it all in a day or two. Because they were hasty in trying to gain a profit. But this is also true for other things too. Pleasure and enjoyment. Pleasure and enjoyment is not necessarily wrong in and of itself. But there's pleasure that God intends for us to have and pleasure that the world offers. And for God's pleasure, it's pleasure that is longer lasting. It's a pleasure that allows for a clear conscience afterwards and enjoyment with others. But you have to be diligent to get there. The pleasure of the world, you can be hasty and get the pleasure of the world, but that pleasure doesn't last, and it tends to create multiple problems, and it becomes less pleasurable the more we pursue it. So it ends up the hasty person, while they gain something immediately, ultimately are rushing to poverty in the end, because the more they get a hold of it, the less it's whatever they think they've gained in that way is held in their hand. This is also true in terms of glory and honor. Pursuing glory and honor is not a bad thing. Maybe in our culture and as Christians, we tend to think, glory and honor, that's we're supposed to be humble. That's not part of humility. But the scriptures talk about God's people pursuing glory and honor. Paul talked about it in Romans, that we can, that's something to pursue, but we need to pursue it in God's way. And, if we pursue glory and honor in God's way, which we do that through perseverance in well-doing, which requires diligence, right? We have to be diligent down the road. Perseverance implies diligence down the road. If we're willing to do it in God's way, there'll be an eternal profit to it. But if we pursue glory and honor in this life in the way of the world, we may achieve some fame, we may achieve something in this life, but it's not usually something that's going to last. It may not come with the honor that is really honorable and the glory that's really glorious. And in the next life, it definitely will lead to poverty, if not in this life. And I think, you know, if you've followed the news over the last several years, you can find plenty of people who had achieved some measure of glory or honor among people in the world and have lost it all in a very short time because they didn't pursue that glory and honor in a way that was through diligence and perseverance and God's method, but they pursued it in the way that the world had offered to them, and a more hasty gaining of things.
One of the proverbs in the carpentry world is measure twice, cut once. Yes.
Right.
Diligence over haste.
Oh, so there was just a few others in Proverbs. In this chapter alone, verse 21, he who follows after righteousness and kindness finds life, righteousness, and honor. And so it's a following of a long-term pursuit. Verse 6, getting of treasures by lying tongues, right? That's a way to get treasures by a lying tongue. We've seen plenty of people do that, but that's the plan of the hasty that does that. Verse 7, it talks about the violence of the wicked. You know, we use violence in one form or another because it's a hasty way to accomplish a goal. We think we can get our goals. It's not going to achieve a good goal in the end very well, but it has the appearance of achieving our goals quickly. And then verse 17, the one who loves pleasure and wine and oil will not be rich, or will be poor and won't be rich. Again, the loving the pleasures of the world and the passing pleasures, it's a way to get what you want now or gain those pleasures quickly, but not something that lasts. It's not the same pleasures that come through diligently pursuing them God's way.
Can I just add Proverbs 19, 2 and 3? Somebody want to look that up real quick and read that for us? Proverbs 19, verses 2 and 3.
It is good to have zeal without knowledge. Sorry, it is not good to have zeal without knowledge, nor to be hasty and miss the way. A man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord.
Right. Hurry, and you make mistakes, but who do you blame? This one says you blame God, probably blame the people around you. Only not so eager to take responsibility for our haste. Yes. Someone else.
I have 21. Whoever pursues righteousness and love finds life, prosperity, and learns. So my first thought was to do the opposite. So if I decided whoever pursues infidelity might meet with death, definitely loses prosperity because divorce is a really good way to lose a lot of money. And,
could I just add, I just was with a gentleman who, I'm not smiling because of the situation, but because of the link. He said, the most economically foolish decision you can make is get a divorce.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just ruins you financially. Now go ahead.
Yeah, and then, of course, in the process of the whole thing, there's going to be a whole lot of not honorable conversations and stress and horriblenesses. And then taking it line by line, if I think about whoever pursues righteousness and love, pursuing versus not pursuing like being complacent or lazing around or ignoring a problem or ignoring the idea of pursuing righteousness and love, or maybe pursuing entertainment or something for myself, or maybe I just want to just get by and not even think about it. That I'm just saying that, that's the opposite, but it doesn't get you where you want to go. I thought it was interesting in the song that we sang, it said that Christ is righteousness and love. And so it's pretty cool that, you know, pursuing Christ and pursuing his way is pursuing loving others more than yourself, loving God. It's pursuing right living and being on a good path. And even if it's imperfectly done, pursuing Jesus and pursuing righteousness and love brings peace in the home, which is worth, you know, all the riches that you have. During that final life, and I was thinking about aliveness versus deadness. Like, sometimes you might walk around and kind of feel dead, or it's really depression or some sort of low living. And aliveness has like an energy to it, smiles, interesting, finding God and finding beauty. It just has a lot of hope and a lot of promise to the aliveness. So thinking about like a plant growing, or it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see something growing and living. And then prosperity, money, like if you're pursuing righteousness and love, money-wise or need-wise, in a way, you're gonna figure out a way to have enough, because God takes care of you. There's nothing in this world that can take away Jesus, and that's prosperity in and of itself, because his life, his love, his power, his strength, his gifts, his purposes, that's a whole lot of prosperity that's not necessarily, you know, in the dollar marks, but it is in living wise, in life, in quality of life, and in making the community work together well, and sharing him. And then the last word, honor. It might not seem like a thing to me personally, because I'm not growing up in a culture that's big on that, but in reality, if I think about like the opposite, it is a really big deal. Like, if you lose reputation, you lose friends. You know, they think weird things about you, and so it's uncomfortable. There's you lose a level of fellowship with them.
Yeah, thanks. This is a question. What is the difference between pursuing and finding? Is there a difference? He who pursues righteousness and love, or loving kindness, finds, New American Standard, life, righteousness, and honor. What's the difference between pursuing and finding, or is there a difference?
Jesus says, if you seek, you will find.
Now, he does say that, yes.
But there's joy in both of them.
Well, not saying that, yeah.
Yeah,
there is joy in both of them. So the idea is that you pursue, if I pursue loving my wife, it turns out that I discover I have a happier wife, hopefully, and we have a better life. So it's the outcome. You discover, wow, this is a wonderful outcome. But you have to pursue the right thing to get that wonderful outcome. If you pursue the outcome, your attitude, your mindset, your values are still self-interested. You can't pursue righteousness and love and be self-interested. The outcome of that is the abundant life that Jesus Christ promised, is it not? Yeah, that's what you find. You go, wow, this really works. This brings me to a better place. Look what I found. Yeah. So there is a difference between pursuing and finding. But you have to pursue it to find it. Yeah. Someone else.
Since Hannah's right here, she ended up hopping around. I'll do this one. I was going to save it till last. But
which one are you doing?
Proverbs 30.
Number 30.
Says, there is no wisdom, no understanding, and no counsel against the Lord. And just a couple things on that. One, it's as I get older, I see the wisdom in that, because it used to be that I would go days arguing with God over either known circumstances or just ideas or stuff, as if I had something to, as if I could win the argument. And I just find more and more now, as I again, as I get older and lose more arguments, a couple things came to mind, both from Joe. One where he said, and I'm really grateful for this, that he said, though you slay me, still I'll trust you, but I will bring my, this is my own interpretation, I'll bring my arguments before you. So God allows us to come to him. It doesn't have to be a disrespectful or a negative thing. We can bring our own arguments to him. And then with Job's, in Job 42, the heading here is Job's confession. He says, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have declared that which I do not understand, which I discover every time I argue with God. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask you, and you instruct me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I retract, and I repent in dust and ashes. And I haven't done that yet, but at least not physically, but certainly that's the general outcome, and I think rightly so, of more of my conversations with God.
Very good. Along with that, let's somebody look up Isaiah 40, verses 13 and 14. Who will take that? Isaiah 40, verses 13 and 14. Somebody. All right. And Romans 11, verses 33 to 36. All right. Let's do the Isaiah one first.
Is that 13 and 14?
Yes, verses 13 and 14.
Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? And who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding?
Yeah, who? All right, and the Romans 11, similar statement.
30 and 33.
Yes, 36.
Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and unfathomable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who became his counselor, or who has first given to him that it would be paid back to him? For from him, and through him, and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen.
So So he is omnipotent and omniscient, all-powerful, all-knowing. He's all-wise. If we are going to submit to him, though, we must trust him. In my opinion, to trust him like that, you have to be convinced, or at least choose, to believe that he is perfectly good. 1 John, I think it's 1:6. There is no darkness in him at all. Yes, he is perfectly good. Someone else?
On this same one, I was looking at it from a tiny different angle. I found it really comforting because, you know, some things that are happening in the world, or maybe politics or something, and, you know, it's like whatever your wisdom, quote unquote, is, really some of it is trickiness, or whatever world insight or plans, none of that can succeed against the Lord, and it's just it's really comforting.
Mm-hmm.
The verse that I wanted to talk about was verse 17.
Okay, verse 17.
Yep. He who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich. And I just thought of how overdoing it on the pleasure scene in the market purchase in the desert. there's a lot of pleasurable things in the earth for us as believers, as children of God, to experience, such as discovery, enjoyment of relationships, and opportunities to grow as we pursue something. We learn things through the experience. There's family, well, just shared experience. I think I trusted that. And then, it's similar to what Deanna was saying in her first talk, let me back up. But the world, Satan, and even in our own hearts, we have a tendency to pervert these things that are good and really mess them up. And Satan takes advantage of that tendency in our hearts. So we do need to be careful about who we listen to and who we what we choose to do with our time, our money, our energy. Some of the results of getting on a slippery slope, and it does get slipperier and slipperier the longer you stay in that pursuit of pleasure. You become poor, it says, and I just thought of some of the ways that we could become poor would be through loss of relationship, loss of use of our mind, loss of use of our body, loss of money, maybe to the point where we have no home, which provides our, where we find basic needs. We lose opportunities. We also lose influences. And these are all things that could have been used for God's glory, and yet here we are jeopardizing them and losing.
Yes. Thanks. Just one additional thought to that. If you look at it this way, not that you have to, pleasure makes us feel good, at least in the moment. Wine dulls our senses so we don't feel so bad. And if oil is medicinal, then it gives us relief from our ailments. And when we make those things, the things we love, not the pleasure, the oil, or the wine, but what it does for us, that means we're not turning to God to give us comfort or joy or peace or to carry us through. And that's a real loss. Yeah. Someone else.
Just a couple additional things to the last two verses, 30 and 31. 30 warns us not to fight against the Lord, and 32 encourages us not to fight without him. It doesn't condemn earthly resources, but reliance on him. Psalm 20, verse 7, some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. Isaiah 31, 1, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but they do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord.
One of the accompanying ideas to what Barbie was just reading, that last one, Jerusalem was known to be a city that was so well fortified, it would be very difficult to defeat it. And yet, God defeated it through the Babylonians. They breached the wall. They were actually able to break through the wall. Yeah. The nations around respected Jerusalem as a very well-protected city. Think of Jericho. God brought the walls down. Right? Yeah. So who do we depend on? Someone else?
I can say one. You know, you are teaching on all kinds of revolutions. One time, we made up all these 3x5 cards of everything that needed to be said and good ways to say it, all following the guidelines for conflict resolution. But but in the end, you don't use those, all that preparation. They're in your back pocket, you know. And then you're relying on the Holy Spirit to guide you through your conversations. But no matter what, it might not have gone well, or the victory is still with God.
Yes, it is.
I combine 23 and 24. He who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from troubles. Proud, haughty, scoffer are his names, who acts with insolent pride. And I just thought, in what ways do I or other people not guard our tongues, or do guard our tongues, but need God's help doing so? So criticizing, little white lies or big lies, angry attacks, outbursts, gossip, sarcasm, complaining, talking too much, antagonizing, belittling, swearing, disparaging comments, talking negatively about someone instead of going to that person. So you avoid all sorts of trouble when you don't do those things. And so for 24, all those things are all hallmarks of pride. My way is right, my way is best, you're wrong. I'm who's important around here. Look at what I know that you don't know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, stuff like that. Insolent pride, by the way, is thinking of yourself as so superior that you believe you're justified in despising or meanly mistreating somebody else. Like, I'm justified in this. I don't know if you've ever thought that yourself, like you have justified mistreating somebody because they've mistreated you or they're not the nicest person, but it's just sin. It's ungodliness. By the way, a good example of the second one, 24, in my opinion, is the story of Haman, who wanted Mordecai killed, but not only Mordecai, he wanted all the Jews killed. He didn't just want to get rid of Mordecai. He wanted to get rid of Mordecai's whole tribe, whole group, people group. That's insolent pride. You know. Someone else? Thanks.
I wonder, just better to live on a corner of a roof than share a house with a quarrelsome wife. I was thinking, why wouldn't a husband want to hide far from a wife rather than be attacked or weak through defensiveness? I was thinking, you know, like in the dining room, and what should be the heart of the home? Why wouldn't they rather be on the roof than in the heart of the home? That was a safe place to be. And then, and, you know, putting on the new man with, you know, a husband would be comfortable and safe in a home near the wife, no matter what he says or does. And see, sharing his home with a wife who has a quiet and gentle spirit. I just started to try to look at what it would look like to be the opposite of quarrelsome. A wife who has a gentle and quiet spirit, who does what's right and does not get into fear, who's quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, and again, does not give in, give way to fear. So those are just sort of some of the things that pull apart from those. And I also appreciated what was said on the others. I looked at multiple ones with a lot of questions in here.
Yeah, let me just read several of the Proverbs that go along with verse 9. Proverbs 21, verse 19, it is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. Proverbs 19, verse 13, a foolish son is destructive to his father, and the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping. In Proverbs 27, verses 15 and 16, a constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. He who would restrain her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Pretty powerful message. And I suggested last Sunday that you ladies would have the privilege to come with a proverb for the men. Just let me state this principle. It's better to live alone than with a husband or wife who is hard to please, rarely content, often argumentative, and makes you pay an emotionally painful price for displeasing them. So it's not just wives, it's husbands. And this message was driven home to me when one day Barbie and I were talking, and I know you can't imagine she would ever do something like this, but we were talking about our history and how bad I was as a husband. And she said, there were times when I just wanted to get in the car and keep driving. So when you think about that, she would rather be alone than with me because being with me was not very pleasant. So that goes for husbands as well as wives, these proverbs, at least for me. And that was a real eye-opener. It was a good reminder that, wow, I was not the loving husband I thought I was. So it isn't just the ladies that can create problems in a home. The husbands can too. Certainly was true in our home. One more and we need to quit.
Well, I wanted to comment on those that, you know, if you just read through it, it's easy to think, well, you know, maybe some for this proverb, they just wanted to state the obvious.
Read through
the book of Proverbs, and you come to verse 9 or 19 in this chapter, you'd think, oh, well, that's just the obvious, and you pass on. But it would seem that the Proverbs are stated for a reason, and more than just to state the obvious. And it made me wonder, so why would anyone then, if it's better to dwell in the corner of a rooftop or in a desert land than with a contentious or fretful, irritable, angry woman, you know, why would anyone do it then? And it was reminded of what God has joined together. He said, let no man separate. So there, you know, it's not a matter of just like, hey, this is just, you know, not good. It's the reason they're still together, though, is because God joined them, that they've been joined before God. And God said that shouldn't be separated. In some cultures, spouses have little to no choice over who they marry. And perhaps we should have pity or mercy on those spouses who find themselves in this bad situation. But even perhaps more so, if you're the parent of young people ready to get married or a matchmaker, perhaps this proverb should remind us to make this something to consider strongly, right? Who, it's not just a matter of whether the spouse has a good education or a good, comes from, you know, whatever it is, right? Whatever might be valued, this is something that should be important. There's long-term effects when making this match. In cultures such as ours, where we're left to make our own choice, generally, of who we marry, we ought to consider this verse before we pursue that to the end, whether that means looking into that ourselves, or perhaps even more so, asking those with knowledge of the other person, or who have wisdom, who can look with a clear eye and mind on the relationship, and perhaps be honest with us and say, yes, this is good, or no, here's what I see in your future, right? Anyway, it just, you know, reading those made me think there's more reason to this than just stating, hey, this is the obvious and, it, you know, you're sorry, you're stuck. Hey, here's something to consider, right, for the future when making decisions, whether it's for yourself or for children or for others. You know, this is an important thing that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yes, it is. And I'm sorry, were you done?
Yes.
Yes, it is something important. One of the important things for me has been to, in almost all cases, never perform a wedding that I haven't been able to counsel the participants. So that at least I have some knowledge that they've heard how to love each other, how to work out differences, how to communicate, how not to, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's really important. And why don't we end with that?
Can I comment on that?
Yes, go ahead.
I like the flip side that you had to Mark's, Mark was talking about the person experiencing that type of spouse, but then there is our consideration of being that kind of spouse.
Yes, we should not be that kind of a spouse. For you,
it's causing pain.
For you, it's love your wife as Christ loves the church. For me too, right? Yes. He doesn't treat us that way. We ought not to treat our spouse that way. Yes, the standard is rather high for the husbands. Rather high.